The following is For Your Ears Only. Now in our 31st year on air, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Euro pushback, a socialist presidential win in France, and other political opposition to Berlin-ordered austerity raise fears of a new crisis in Europe and U.S. spillover.
Infiltrating Al-Qaeda, fallout from a double agent's foiling of another underwear bomb plot. But where are Islamists winning?
Jackie After O, a new book examines the year in which twice-widowed Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis made herself a model for independent women.
Pulitzer picks and pans. Movie critic Wes Morris, now a Pulitzer Prize winner, rates recent releases and previews summer cinema 2012.
The Chocolate Cure, new science underscores the health benefits of cocoa. No Snickers, please.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for Your Ears Only, a production of Gatewave.org, the nonprofit 24/7 radio reading service for those with disabilities. For Your Ears Only for the week of May 13th and Mother's Day. Hi, Mom. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth.
Je mesure aussi que l'Europe nous regarde.
Europe is looking at us. And when the result was made public, I'm sure that in many countries in Europe, it was relief, hope, the idea that at last austerity would no longer be seen as unavoidable.
Socialist leader François Hollande was reflecting more than the usual political ego last week after his election as president of France. All across the financially troubled Eurozone, voters have been rising up against elected officials who march too obediently to austerity commands coming out of thriving Germany. But the opposition of democracy to austerity leaves some analysts worried about a major European collapse that could drag the U.S. economy back down with it.
To consider that possibility, a $2 billion trading loss by the biggest U.S. bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, and the state of the U.S. economy generally, for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Daniel Gross, economics editor and columnist at Yahoo Finance. His new book is Better, Stronger, Faster, The Myth of American Decline and the Rise of a New Economy from Free Press. Welcome back to our show.
It's good to be here.
For all the initial worries, Wall Street took the anti-austerity results of elections in France and Greece last weekend with relative resilience.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the case of Greece, we've already assumed for a long time that it's a basket case, that things will never get better there. They've written off a good chunk of their debt. There's probably a lot more to come, and everybody's been taking evasive action about Greece for a couple years now. And with France, with the socialist elected president, there's the sense that maybe the mood has changed. Instead of doing this austerity, which has been self-defeating and only led to lower economic growth and more financial crises, that there will now be a force at the heart of Europe saying, let's look for something that's a little more expansionary. Let's try to get growth going, because in the long term, growth is the only solution to the problem of unemployment and budget deficits.
And there were reports that German leader Angela Merkel might meet Hollande with some willingness to compromise, if not on the extent of austerity Germany requires to keep supporting financial relief, at least on the time span for it.
Merkel and Sarkozy were really of one mind, so much so that they were referred to as, you know, Merkozy, as if they were like Brangelina at the heart of Europe. We're not going to see a similar mind meld between the two. And I think she looks around and sees that in all these other countries in Europe, the politicians who have implemented austerity have all been voted out of office. We've seen changes in Ireland. David Cameron's not looking so hot in the UK, in Italy. And so it's clear the public is kind of revolting against us, which makes it harder to continue imposing that. And I think, again, that the election in France has really solidified that maybe it's time to think about a slightly different tack. Not that Merkel is suddenly going to come out and say, hey, let's stimulate the economies like crazy, but she has to realize the new political realities.
Barring total chaos, a Greek word, you note, Eurozone financial woes actually work in America's favor, continuing to draw foreign investment to U.S. stocks and government bonds with lower borrowing costs for our treasury, right?
Whenever something bad happens in the world, people rush to buy U.S. government debt. Even though people were talking about a default, even though our political system is dysfunctional, it's the safest, most liquid asset around. And so we saw the yield on the 10-year bonds up to 1.9, 1.8%, which means that the government can borrow for very cheap, but ultimately homeowners can borrow for more cheaply, and companies. So they're going to go out, refinance their debt, make their profits look a little better. And this is one of the reasons I talk about it in my book about why the U.S. may not be in such decline. If everybody keeps turning to us for a safe haven, that really redounds to our benefit.
But also that your book says they're turning to us for our products, rapidly expanding exports. Give us some numbers on that.
So exports started to turn up in April 2009. They hit bottom, $124 billion a month. They've risen on a monthly basis by 50%. We just got the exports numbers for March, $186 billion. So I like to say, you know, we don't make anything the world wants except the $186 billion in agricultural products, planes, machines, and services, tourism, higher education. When people from abroad come here and spend money, that's an export. And as the rest of the world has grown richer, they are showing a willingness and desire to buy what we're selling, whether it's at home or whether they come here to do it.
But there's also entertainment, the movies, the television, the arts that we put out.
People are concerned about the prospects for growth in the U.S. If the domestic economy is only growing 2% and you're saturated here, how do you get growth as a company or an industry? And the answer is to get more involved in overseas markets. You know, the Avengers, that movie that just opened, had a blockbuster first weekend in the U.S. doing $160 million. But it opened up overseas on April 25th and had already done $450 million overseas. Our business models, our products, whether it's Hannah Montana CDs or movies, Starbucks, they travel remarkably well. And in these past few years, when we've been sort of down on the U.S., a lot of these companies and products have really made great inroads into these very large markets overseas where people are, for the first time, having the cash to consume like middle-class people.
The improved state of American business is less obvious in the slow pace of job growth and not at all in wages. You also fault U.S. banks for hoarding record sums since they got big federal bailouts when the economy needs that money to grow. And the banks have been very embarrassed this past week by the situation at J.P. Morgan Chase, where they apparently lost $2 billion in trading that was meant to serve as a hedge against other potential losses. Are you seeing a return to push for more regulation and oversight?
Well, you know, J.P. Morgan Chase was supposed to be the smart bank. Jamie Dimon was supposed to be the smart banker. And the book about him was called Last Man Standing because he was the only institution through the financial crisis intact. And what we saw, this $2 billion loss that materialized on some complex products, really, I think, shakes the confidence in investors in Dimon and should make us think twice about the safety of our banking system. But it also really, you know, gives the lie to this argument that the banks don't need regulation, that they're fine and, you know, they've learned their lesson, they manage their own risk, they have all the incentives to do so. The reality is they take money, they take it from depositors, they take it from the Federal Reserve, it costs virtually nothing. And in ways big and small, they continue to gamble with it. And as long as we continue to be implicated in that, insuring deposits, insuring their debt, and being the sort of last stop when they get into real trouble, we as citizens and as a government should have a real interest in what they do, which argues for more regulation rather than less.
Beyond regulation and oversight, are there incentives to lending that might be tried, especially in the area of mortgages, but others as well? We know rates are at a record low, but it still seems to be so hard for many people to negotiate or renegotiate their terms.
We're at a stage in the recovery where companies of all types, whether it's McDonald's paying more wages, companies paying more dividends, banks being a little looser with credit, they've restored their balance sheets. They have record profits. The U.S. corporate sector had corporate profits of $1.9 trillion in 2011. They've got to give that up a little bit.
Daniel Gross is economics editor and columnist at Yahoo Finance. His new book is Better, Stronger, Faster, The Myth of American Decline and the Rise of a New Economy from Free Press.
Quote from the news, many economic problems that we face are actually political problems in disguise. That was Renmin University political scientist Zhang Min on China's slowing economic growth because of limits to central planning, party infighting, and high-level corruption.
Next, infiltrating al-Qaeda and watching it spread. For your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Not only Christ sacrificing himself on our behalf, but it's also the golden rule, you know, treat others the way you would want to be treated. That was President Obama connecting his religious beliefs with a long evolving decision to support same-sex marriage, even as North Carolina, a key state for his campaign, became the 30th to ban it. But analysts said Obama had already lost voters who disagree on the issue and might re-energize gay marriage supporters and other liberals who had come to doubt his convictions. Mitt Romney, meanwhile, repeated his opposition to gay marriage, even civil unions, and apologized after reports he had bullied effeminate-seeming students as a teen in boarding school. Now this.
The access to information that enables us to identify persons both within the United States but also without the United States that would hurt us, but also our intelligence agencies to operate overseas to pull in this information has been essential and remains essential.
FBI Director Robert Mueller on Capitol Hill last week stressed the importance of electronic surveillance in the wake of news that another al-Qaeda airline bomb plot had been foiled. But it turned out the real key was an old-fashioned double agent, Saudi with a British passport by some accounts, who penetrated the terrorist group, volunteered for the suicide mission with a new form of underwear bomb, then turned it over for analysis by U.S. intelligence.
News accounts of that operation triggered another Obama administration leak investigation, but they may also be causing internal problems of confusion, suspicion, even some paralysis within al-Qaeda, associated terror and Islamist groups, even as they continue to make inroads in Syria, Libya, North Africa, and elsewhere. To consider all that, we're joined again by Dr. Waleed Faris, a professor of global strategies and advisor to the U.S. House of Representatives Anti-Terrorism Caucus. His latest book is The Coming Revolution, Struggle for Freedom in the Middle East, from Threshold Editions. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you for having me.
After all the talk about al-Qaeda being too close-knit and clan-like to be easily infiltrated, were you surprised that this double agent succeeded?
No, not at all. I mean, in the volume of how many al-Qaeda strikes have occurred, not just against the United States, but also liberal democracies and in the Arab and Muslim world, for us to be able, or the West or the United States or its allies, to be able to infiltrate, to place one successful individual inside the al-Qaeda network, that's a reason to be, you know, satisfied, but that's not a reason to be surprised. That's what we should be doing all the time, everywhere against al-Qaeda.
Does it show al-Qaeda's desperation at this point, deteriorating security standards?
I don't think al-Qaeda now is what it has been described by many, including in Washington or some other quarters. Al-Qaeda's real objective is to seize land, seize territory, penetrate societies, and that's what it's doing in the big picture. Now, of course, we are scoring tactical, tremendous tactical successes and victories against al-Qaeda, but on a strategic level, al-Qaeda is expanding while we are scoring some of these important tactical victories.
It's a classic intelligence tactic to leak news of an infiltration to sow discord in enemy ranks. Do you think to any degree that's happening now inside al-Qaeda and associated groups as they look to see who this double agent associated with, become suspicious of anybody that he had contact with?
Yes, but not to the strategic level that we seem to see. Meaning, of course, if we have a person infiltrating al-Qaeda, especially if we do it with the Saudis, who have great experience, who knows the ideology, and they were partially also part of the success, this is going to create a reaction within the operational network of al-Qaeda. But is this going to impact the madrasas? Is this going to impact the recruitment of more jihadists? No. If you look at their chat rooms product, you'll see that they're going to say, well, this was a defeat, but we are here to expand and gain more and more support around the globe and specifically in the Middle East. So, yes, again, from our perspective, we have to be very careful. From our perspective, this is a victory that may create reverberation inside al-Qaeda. From the al-Qaeda perspective, this is a loss, but they're moving forward.
Apart from the double agent setback, you see al-Qaeda and associated groups actually gaining ground in key areas despite the elimination of Osama bin Laden, most notably now in Syria. Some experts blame it for the most recent deadly attacks on Assad government targets. What's your view on that and al-Qaeda's goal in Syria?
Let me make a distinction between how we in the West in general, and America in particular, look at al-Qaeda, both successes and defeats, and how they look at themselves. We are fighting against the al-Qaeda of 2001. Most of the key figures that we are eliminating, beginning with Osama bin Laden, to al-Awlaki and others, have been the historic leaders and founders or main leaders of al-Qaeda. Real al-Qaeda on the ground is now metastasizing and expanding in Africa, in Yemen, in Somalia, and of course in Syria, And in Syria, the Al-Qaeda network is not just Al-Qaeda. You have Salafi jihadists, and they have been in Syria for a long period of time. Now is an opportunity for them because there is a breakdown between the regime and the opposition, as was the case in Libya, as was the case in Yemen. They are taking advantage and trying to expand and create their enclaves inside Syria.
So are they working in association to some degree with old allies within the Assad regime? Are they totally independent? I mean, their activity there is making potential supporters of rebel forces very concerned about giving support that may end up being used against us as it was in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. And we need to be very careful in extending our support. I have advised many times many members of Congress not to engage in the so-called, quote-unquote, supporting the rebels of Syria. There are many rebels, many networks, the seculars, the democracy promoters, even the Muslim conservatives and Christian minorities and Kurds. Those need to be supported. But you have Salafi jihadi networks and militias growing across Syria because we have been in the international community very late in coming to help the Syrian people. Of course, Al-Qaeda and the jihadists are going to come from a variety of points in the Middle East and insert themselves in the struggle, making it very difficult now for the international community to extend their support to a global resistance. We have to be more specific and see which part of that resistance we need to support.
Talk about Al-Qaeda inroads in the multi-militia matrix of Libya after Gaddafi.
Well, basically, in Libya, we had a choice to bring down Gaddafi and, of course, after that, support the rebels. Meanwhile, there was a struggle within the rebels between the seculars, the ex-military, the ex-bureaucrats, and the Islamist militias. The Islamist militias, at the end of the day, won the game on the inside. They are the ones who are in control of government. But those Islamist militias are of many backgrounds, and they control different areas and different places of the country. And they do also, you know, sometimes fight against each other. The bottom line is that in Libya, what you're going to see is the rise of an Islamist regime that would be very rich, that has the petrodollars, and will be inclined to support Islamist militias, for example, in northern Mali, in the Sahel area, in many places in Africa. And that's why we need to be very careful about how do we support, who do we support when a change occurs in the Middle East.
How do you see the situation in Egypt, where the long-feared Muslim Brotherhood now seems to be among the more moderate Islamist factions?
This is, again, another projection of how we read the Islamists. I mean, all Islamist agendas end up in the same direction, the establishment of an emirate, the establishment of a full-fledged, narrow Sharia-implemented state, and ultimately the caliphate. The way to get there, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood have distinguished themselves in accepting the political process to gain power, and once they gain power, they start to implement those laws and will become increasingly more authoritarian against the seculars and the minorities. But next to them, more radical than them, are the Salafi jihadists or the Salafists in Egypt who wants to do a shortcut, who do want to engage in jihad. So now that's why we call the Muslim Brotherhood more moderate than the more radical Salafists. But at the end of the day, once they will have power, they will want to implement the same political agenda.
Dr. Waleed Faris is a professor of global strategies and advisor to the U.S. House of Representatives Anti-Terrorism Caucus. His latest book is The Coming Revolution: Struggle for Freedom in the Middle East, from Threshold Editions.
Quote from the news, I have a mindset that says bipartisanship ought to consist of Democrats coming to the Republican point of view. That was Indiana Treasurer Richard Murdoch, a Tea Party favorite, after trouncing long-term incumbent GOP Senator Richard Lugar and giving Democrats more hope of recapturing that seat in November.
Next, in Icons Independence, Jackie after O, for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. This is their case? That was former trial lawyer John Edwards after federal prosecutors completed their presentation on charges he violated campaign finance laws to hide adultery and an illegitimate child as he ran for president in 2008. But the judge rejected their request for dismissal, and the defense was to begin its presentation this week. Now this.
I think a woman always adapts, and especially if you're very young when you get married and, you know, or unformed, you really become the kind of wife that you can see that your husband wants.
The late Jacqueline Kennedy made headlines last year with release of revealing remarks she recorded only months after the 1963 JFK assassination, including those thoughts on being a good wife. And she's in the news again these days with the release of Pulitzer Prize winner Robert Caro's latest volume on Lyndon Johnson. It tells how LBJ refused to leave Dallas without her and JFK's body, and why each of them thought her bloody, traumatized presence was important for his runway swearing in.
Her views on marriage then were put to the test not long after, when she wed wealth and power again with Aristotle Onassis, not fated to be an easy match. And they may seem a bit incongruous to a younger generation that knew the former First Lady as a super socialite turned iconic single mom, working woman, and dedicated activist for architectural preservation. How she made that transformation after the death of Onassis in 1975 is the subject of another new book, Jackie After O, one remarkable year when Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis defied expectations and rediscovered her dreams, by Tina Cassidy from IT Books, HarperCollins. And for your ears only, Tina Cassidy joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What prompted you to look back at why and how Jackie remade her life and herself?
As you said, a lot's been written about her years as a wife both times, and I wasn't so interested in that. I don't think there was much left to explore, for one thing, but also just because I'm from a different generation, I was really interested in her choice to become a woman who worked when she didn't have to. So specifically, I was interested in her midlife crisis and the massive transformation that happens to her in 1975, which is the year that Onassis dies. You know, not everyone can relate to shopping at Valentino or living on a private island, as Jackie did, but everyone can relate to the question, am I happy with my life? And if not, what should I do about it?
There was initial unpleasantness with the other Onassis heirs, but Jackie was not left in real need. Talk about how and why she decided to go back to work.
Well, yes. In fact, she was a journalist. She was a columnist for a Washington newspaper, taking photographs and asking questions of powerful and interesting people around Washington, but she quit the day JFK proposed and never worked again until 1975. And I think that, you know, that was really interesting to me, how she put her life on hold, her life in some respects on hold. Obviously, she had an amazing life in those intervening years. But this decision really to go out and look for work in 1975 was about her search for meaning at a time when she was looking out over the abyss of, you know, the rest of her life. She was about to become an empty nester, partially anyway, with Caroline graduating from high school that year. And clearly she wanted something that was going to bring her more joy and meaning. And it's a reflection of how smart and intelligent she was. You know, she couldn't just sit around all day and go to parties, especially now that she was no longer a wife and she was free.
And the reaction from publishing friends when she raised the idea of working for them?
Oh, yes. I mean, one of the first people she approached was Jason Epstein at Random House, and she had known Jason from literary circles in New York, and they went out and had a fabulous lunch at the Tess. And he basically said that he couldn't possibly hire her because, you know, there were other people already in line. And, you know, sort of like a country club, she couldn't just cut the line. And she also had no experience in publishing, so he couldn't wrap his head around just going out and hiring the most famous woman in the world at that time. And I think that it was one of Jason's great career regrets.
But she did land a job in publishing, and ironically, it was a novel with a Kennedy character that ended that first publishing job.
Yes. The book was called Shall We Tell the President by British author Jeffrey Archer. And Jackie knew that the book was in the works. Tom Ginsberg, the publisher at Viking, where she ended up in 1975, asked her if it was okay. And she said, you know, do I have to edit it? And he said, no, of course not. And she said, all right, well, as long as I don't have to have anything to do with it, go right ahead. But when the reviews hit, they were bad, and the New York Times basically said, you know, she should be ashamed of herself, meaning Jackie, and the Kennedy family was up in arms about it, and so she just quit in a huff.
One book at her next job was about 18th and 19th century American women, including first ladies, that had some lines that made her laugh.
Yes. The first book she edited at Viking, in fact, was called Remember the Ladies, and it was a historic look at first ladies. There were a couple lines from Martha Washington in the book, one that said, I lead a dull life as a state prisoner, and Jackie thought that was pretty funny. And the other quote from Martha Washington was that Georgetown is a dirty hole, to which Jackie said, yes, it still is.
What led her to the architecture preservation movement and Grand Central Station?
I think that she was always deeply interested in architecture and history. I saw that in her letters from Europe when she was still in college. It was clear that she admired the architecture of great cities like Paris and Venice and so forth. I think by the time 1975 rolls around and the railroad says that they want to put an office tower where Grand Central was, that she was probably a little bit more reflective about it. She really understood how the past connected to the future, and she cared deeply about the city of New York, which is a city that her grandfather had helped develop. In fact, he developed 740 Park, which today remains one of the most luxurious co-op buildings in the city. So Grand Central to her represented something that was meaningful, and she didn't want to see it go.
One line in your book that caught my attention from my old New York Post colleague Pete Hamill was that taking Jackie out, which he did, was like taking King Kong to the beach because of all the public attention. She also went out with my former Newsweek magazine colleague Ed Klein, who was then editor of the New York Times magazine, whose book on her you cite on other matters. What can you say about her social, her dating life in 1975 and after?
She dated some men. Clearly, it was hard to date Jackie. I think the most significant date that she has in 1975 is with Maurice Templesman, who is the man who was with her when she eventually died in 1994. They had a very long and warm relationship. Maurice, however, remained married and, you know, never got divorced. So he and Jackie never married, obviously.
Tina Cassidy's new book is Jackie After O, one remarkable year when Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis defied expectations and rediscovered her dreams, from IT Books, HarperCollins. Of course, it was Jackie who helped draw the JFK Camelot connection, as made most poignantly by the late Richard Burton.
Don't let it be forgotten that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment.
Next, movie Picks and Pans from another Pulitzer winner, for your ears only.
We're back for your ears only. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Dear Mr. Sendak, how much does it cost to go where the wild things are? That was the letter from an 8-year-old fan of the most famous of more than a dozen dark but dearly loved children's books by author-artist Maurice Sendak, who died last week at 83. Now this.
Hello, Barnabas. Remember me?
Witch.
You cursed me to be this hideous creature.
You may strategically place your wonderful lips upon my posterior and kiss it repeatedly. What?
You don't usually think of dark shadows as a sign of summer, but they are this year at least a new movie version of the old gothic TV soap opera, with Johnny Depp as the blood-sucking ham, a totally self-conscious, irresistibly irreverent 18th-century vampire culturally adrift in the swinging 1970s.
And Dark Shadows, the movie, is just the start of Summer Cinema 2012. To talk about some of the recent releases and what's to come for your ears only, we're pleased to be joined again by Boston Globe critic Wesley Morris, recently awarded a Pulitzer Prize for his reviews. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. How are you guys?
Very well. Tell me, some Dark Shadows purists from its TV era say the new Tim Burton Johnny Depp version is too disrespectful, but you and fellow Globe critic Ty Burr found it good fun. How is Depp?
Yeah, he's good. I mean, I think he's obviously enjoying himself. He and Tim Burton have an obvious thing. You know, they work well together. They have a good chemistry, and I think Johnny Depp is... He likes playing sort of like dark characters in general, and I think that this is a part that suits him perfectly. He gets to be hammy, he gets to be funny, and the joke is basically this gothic 18th century character winds up in 1972. So you have these two eras sort of making fun of each other in some ways, and it's very funny. The comedy is really good. The problem with the movie, of course, is that it turned into an action movie for the last 45 minutes, but... Until then, everybody seems to be mostly on the same page about how to make it funny.
Already a blockbuster from another medium is The Avengers, based on the Marvel Comics superheroes. And you say it's a rare pleasure when a film captures the madcap spirit of a comic book. Talk about that quality.
Well, it's hard to do. Other movies have tried to do it. I think Ang Lee's Hulk, which is about The Incredible Hulk from a number of years ago, which people sort of dismissed as being too serious, not enough fun, and not having enough action, I think it's really a good example of how you can take a comic book and turn it into a film. But it was a sort of more literal idea of how to do that by breaking the screen into frames and having those frames do different things. Joss Whedon, the director and the writer of this Avengers movie, actually just figures out, he knows how comic book characters talk. He knows how the framing works in the comic book, so you don't need the paneling device, which is clever, but you don't. It's interesting to watch, see a movie not need that, to just be able to capture what basically is a joyous experience for a lot of people, which is to open a comic book, see plot unfold, close it, and you move on to the next one. I mean, it's not terribly deep, and the moments in which it, you know, the moments where it tries to do more than it can really intellectually handle, or the moments, they really don't work very well. One of them involves Captain America sort of having a Nazi flashback in Stuttgart with Loki, and it's an attempt to do something that I don't think Whedon is really quite engaged in the real world enough to do. but as a movie, you know, as a movie based on a comic book that comprises the characters from other movies that weren't really very good, it's surprisingly smart and fun. I had a very good time.
Looking further into the summer's films, Sacha Baron Cohen's Dictator disappoints, you say.
I think it should be smarter than it is. Satires are hard to do. I think the problem with this movie, though, is that he doesn't really know what the idea is. Is the idea that this fake Middle Eastern despot winds up in a Brooklyn food co-op and is simultaneously involved in a plot to sort of outsource his or sell his company to these sort of oil interests. I don't know exactly what the joke is, but occasionally there's a joke within the joke that's very funny. All the stuff in the food co-op is actually pretty cool and smart and worked out. And, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen and Larry Charles, the director of this movie, they're really good at culture clashes. And I think this movie is at its best when it is taking one sort of farcical culture and putting it in the context of another sort of farcical culture, and that's where the comedy comes from that tension.
Battleship is a popular board game transformed. For better or worse, do you predict?
I don't know. I don't know how one plays Battleship and says, oh my God, you know what? A movie, right? I don't know how you get there. Like, and then not only that, this movie has to be at least extremely entertaining, because not only did they get to the point where they wanted to turn the board game into a movie, they said, oh, and you know what we should really do is cast Rihanna to do something. So, I don't know.
You note that the promise of last year's Bridesmaids has not materialized with many more starring roles for women. In fact, men have been moving into feminine territory, as in What to Expect When You're Expecting. Talk about that.
Well, it's just interesting that I mean, the movies are usually, there's some lag time at the movies where you expect at some point that the thing that happened last summer would just keep happening, but that's not necessarily the case, because movies that go into production, you know, in May of 2011 probably won't see a theater until, you know, the following, you know, until 2013. So it's possible that whatever was supposed to happen with Bridesmaids in terms of women and comedy won't happen until next year, but it also is like more likely that all of that energy, all that sort of feminine comedic energy is on television. You know, it's all over the television, but it's not really at the movies. But What to Expect When You're Expecting is sort of, it takes the baby thing, and I haven't seen it yet, but it turns, you know, childbirth and pregnancy into something that, I mean, obviously men experience this too, but it seems to be that the men sort of occupy half the movie in a way that, you know, is like woe for them.
What else are you particularly looking forward to on the big screen this summer?
You know, as everyone else in the world, I'm looking forward to The Dark Knight, the new Batman movie. There's a Will Ferrell, Zach Galifianakis movie called The Campaign that sort of asks us to believe that these two people could be running for office. It has a promisingly silly premise that I think might actually work. Sparkle, the movie based on the musical with Whitney Houston. There's an Oliver Stone movie that looks really good called Savages, or it looks promising. I don't know if it'll work, but he's making another one of these noirish sorts of ensemble movies. And I mean, he's at his best lately when he's not sort of focused on a bigger picture or trying to exorcise some kind of political demons.
Boston Globe critic Wesley Morris recently won a Pulitzer Prize for his reviews.
And a quote from the news, "I didn't have a picture of what hair should be, but I had a definite picture of what hair shouldn't be." That was Vidal Sassoon, responsible for the elevation of women's hairstyling as a VIP art, dead last week at 84.
Next, the Health Cocoa Connection, for your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Melissa Axelberth with a quote from the news. "Rare but serious adverse effects." That was an FDA report on long-term use of popular bone-strengthening drugs, such as Fosamax and Boniva and Reclast, including femur fractures, esophageal cancer, and painful deforming osteonecrosis of the jaw.
Here's another, an amazing opportunity to turn the tide on this epidemic. That was a member of the Food and Drug Administration panel that recommended AIDS prevention in some high-risk populations with a drug already used to treat those infected with the HIV virus. Another panel recommended approval of a new prescription anti-obesity drug, the first in 13 years. Now this.
"My mom always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get."
Actually, most people are pretty sure they know what they'll get from that box of chocolates. Zits, cavities, and fat. But wait, when it comes to the heart, new studies indicate chocolate could actually be beneficial. And not just to show your love on Mother's Day or to your sweetheart. There's growing evidence that flavonoids found in chocolate could protect against high blood pressure and heart disease.
So do we get to indulge guilt-free? What about the fat and calories? For the answer to these and related questions, we turn to the author of several studies on chocolate, including a mega study of studies, Harvard nutritionist and epidemiologist Dr. Eric Ding. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Over the years, we've learned that fruits, vegetables, tea, even wine are major sources of antioxidants, which protect against cardiovascular disease. Where does chocolate, or more specifically, the key ingredient of cocoa, stack up on that list?
Well, I think over the years, there have been many exciting antioxidants that have come and gone over the market, but not many have stood the test of time of hard clinical science, especially many of the vitamins. However, one thing that has recently and emerged that is really robust for heart disease is cocoa flavonoids.
What are they exactly? How do they work?
So cocoa flavonoids specifically, it's a subclass. So not all flavonoids are the same. Flavonoids is a class of antioxidants, but these specific ones have been shown to lower blood pressure, lower your bad cholesterol, raise your good cholesterol, improve your blood flow, and improve glucose and insulin resistance, which may prevent diabetes. So altogether, there's a lot of evidence emerging that it actually may prevent heart disease, among other things.
Is some chocolate better than others? How does milk chocolate stack up against, say, my favorite, which is 80% dark?
Indeed. Not all chocolate bars are alike. Milk chocolate has less of the cocoa flavonoids compared to the dark. But then again, not all darks are alike, too. Some 60% darks are also called darks, while some you can actually get in the range of 90-95% darks, which are very bitter. But these more dark flavonoids, more dark chocolate, the more flavonoids there are. And also there's some suggestion that milk may or not inhibit the absorption of them. So best stick with dark.
What about all the fat and sugar and calories that go along with chocolate? How does their harm weigh against the benefits of the flavonoids?
Indeed. The benefits of cocoa flavonoids are separate of this of the fat and calories. So you can't consume too much chocolate bars, because if you consume too much, you have the fat and the calories will overwhelm the positive benefits of cocoa flavonoids. So it's best to consume them separate of any calories, such as, you know, via some supplements or not, or if you consume chocolate, consume it in place of something so that you're not adding to your net calorie intake.
We're reading there are new ways to get the benefits without the fat, sugar, and calories, food supplements like one called CocoaWell. What's in it, and how well does that work?
Well, CocoaWell has about 450 milligrams of cocoa flavonoids. And what's unique is it's a supplement, and so it avoids all the calorie, sugar, and fat issue. And in our studies, for all these blood pressure and cholesterol benefits, the average dose was between 400 and 500 milligrams a day. And normally, you would have to get about 20 or 30 bars of milk chocolate and 8 to 9 bars of dark chocolate to get that equivalent. However, Cocoa Well delivers it without the specific caloric side effects.
I wonder if it tastes like chocolate. I'm a big fan of fair trade chocolate, dark, but I also have bags of cacao beans that I munch on occasionally. Are there any benefits to just chewing the beans, or has that not been studied?
I think there will be some benefits, but it's not well studied because it's uncertain how much you would get depending on the bean and the absorption. The best way is to get it from the post-processing extracted cocoa, which have the highest concentration. But then again, there's lots of more research to be done in this area, but everything does seem very promising so far.
We're just getting around to it, but chocolate was huge in the Aztec culture, the drink of kings and emperors. It's also been used medicinally for centuries. Talk a little about that history that we're just getting back to.
Well, the medicinal benefits, there have been many claims over the centuries from healing various ailments and disease to improving, for example, some sexual function and memory and mood. And for some of them, there's definitely no evidence. But in terms of some cognitive function, there's actually some evidence that it may have some benefits on, cognitive function and anxiety. But the bulk of the research is on the cardiovascular benefits. And one of the benefits in our study was that it improved blood flow via something called flow-mediated dilation. And the funny thing is, flow-mediated dilation is what actually they had discovered Viagra to originally improve serendipitously. So we don't know if it will have these kind of other benefits, but for cholesterol and blood pressure and these heart disease prevention benefits, I think we're rather confident.
I think that's pretty awesome. Nutritionist and epidemiologist Eric Ding, Ph.D. of Harvard Medical School and author of the Journal of Nutrition Meta-Analysis on the Cardiovascular Benefits of Cocoa.
Chocolate, 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 chocolate cake and chocolate pie. Chocolate, yum, yum, how I wish I had some. I love chocolate till I die.
And this has been for your ears only. For Your Ears Only, On Air is online at iTunes, YouTube, and FeedBurner.com. But to continue, we really need your tax-deductible donation. Please email me at davidearsonly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hangar Studio with interns Daniela Quintanilla and Kaimana Larson. I'm Melissa Axelberth.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a production of the nonprofit Gatewave.org radio reading service with support from the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and award-winning ACAM Associates, Exceptional Management, Impeccable Reputation for New York Co-ops, Condos, and Condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com.
Now we are back with another archive segment, normally a major story on our show a year ago. I'm Kaimana Larson. This week, though, we dig back further to thoughts on the politics of power and the power of prose from Robert Caro, the two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. His new volume on Lyndon Johnson, The Passage of Power, has just been published from our February 8, 2009 Newsweek on-air broadcast hosted by Melissa and David.
No memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long. Weapons do not make peace. Men make peace. And peace comes not through strength alone, but through wisdom and patience and restraint. I shall not see, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Tragedy made Lyndon Johnson president in 1963, but he turned his predecessor's murder into a landmark victory for civil rights. He warned against war as a path to peace in 1964 and won by a landslide in his own right, but then became so entangled in Vietnam that he could not face running for a second full term. Johnson's complexities and contradictions are fully as fascinating as his masterful way with political power in his native Texas, in the U.S. Senate, and in the White House.
And nobody understands Johnson and political power in America better than Robert Caro, who's won two Pulitzer Prizes for biographies of LBJ and New York master builder Robert Moses, The Power Broker, his first bestseller. As a new president tries new approaches to power, Newsweek profiles Caro and his intensive study of the subject, often a decade for each volume, and we're pleased to have him with us now. Welcome back to Newsweek on Air.
Glad to be back, David.
You went from Princeton to the Long Island paper Newsday, where you first came across the ruthless master planning of Robert Moses. What led you next to focus on Johnson years after his presidency and death, and for three decades now?
Well, you know, what I'm really interested in all my books is political power and how it really works. The book on Robert Moses I went to because he was never elected to anything, yet he had held power for 44 years in New York State and New York and City, and had more power than anyone who was elected, more than any mayor or governor. So I figured if I could understand where he got that power and how he used it, I'd be understanding how real power works in city, not what we were taught in textbooks. With Johnson, I wanted to do the same thing with national political power. Both as Senate Majority Leader and as President, he used political power with a real genius, and I wanted to understand it and explain it.
I gather you never met Johnson, but did walk in his footsteps. Talk about deciding actually to live in Texas and what it taught you beyond all the interviews.
Well, Lyndon Johnson was brought up in the hill country of Texas, a very isolated and remote and poor region. When I'm a New York boy, and when I started to do research at the Johnson Library in Austin, I would drive out to the Hill Country and interview the people who grew up with him. And I began to realize I didn't understand them, and I didn't understand this land and what it was like to live in such a remote and isolated place, and that we'd have to live up there so I could get a feeling for it. And I think that, to some extent, helped me understand Lyndon Johnson.
Many readers wonder why you have spent so much time and effort on the pre-presidential Johnson, when what they find most dramatic is his presidency. Why four volumes for one man?
As I said, these books are as much about political power as they are about Lyndon Johnson. So each one has a theme that relates to a part of Johnson's life. The first one is about his rise to power as a young congressman. And what we see there is how he transformed this hill country by bringing electricity to it, which seemed to be an impossible task. You really say, in a way, this shows the power of government to help people when they're fighting forces too big for them to fight themselves, because they were never going to get electricity through private companies. The second book is about a stolen election, how Johnson stole his seat in the Senate by winning by 87 votes, which, of course, were cast 6 days after the polls closed. And we look at stolen elections as an aberration. We're always shocked when we see them. Really, stolen elections are a bigger part of American political life than we want to admit. The third book is called Master of the Senate. You know, before Lyndon Johnson became Majority Leader of the Senate didn't work. It was a place in disarray. And pretty much since he's left as Majority Leader, it's been that same. But for the 6 years when Lyndon Johnson ran the Senate, it was really the center of American governmental energy and ingenuity. So each of those books explores something that I think is worth exploring. Of course, now the presidency, which is what I'm on now, is really fascinating in itself.
Your Princeton thesis was on novelist Ernest Hemingway, 235 pages on a former reporter known for brevity.
Talk about the importance, beyond the facts, of the writing itself in your work, in great biography and nonfiction generally.
Well, to me, one of the things I've tried to do in my books, and to whatever extent they work, is because I try to make the writing at the same level as if I was writing a novel. In my opinion, if a book is going to endure, let's say a nonfiction book, the level of the prose in it, of the writing, has to be at the same level as a great novel that will endure. And you want your books to endure, because if you find out something about political power and you feel people ought to know it, you don't want just one generation to know it. You want the books to go on and be of use to other generations.
Given the present political moment, we have to ask the greatest expert on two of the nation's greatest power brokers, Moses and Johnson, what you think they'd have made of Barack Obama's extraordinary presidential campaign and first embattled weeks in office.
Well, when you talk about Lyndon Johnson and Barack Obama, of course, the great thing to me is that when Lyndon Johnson set out to pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965, blacks basically didn't vote, not in numbers enough to make them significant, the 11 states of the Union, the 11 southern states. Johnson set out to pass this act. A lot of people said you have to include other things in it at first, public accommodations, etc. Johnson said, give them the vote. They can do the rest themselves. And 43 years later, we have an African-American president sitting in the Oval Office. I think Johnson would see Obama's campaign and election as the culmination of his dream. Obama has walked into a tsunami of troubles here that he didn't make, and we're going to just have to wait and see how he navigates this horrible situation he's in. It's really unprecedented, and it'll be interesting to see if he rises to the heights demanded here.
Robert Caro has won two Pulitzer Prizes. His books are The Power Broker, about Robert Moses, and three LBJ volumes so far, The Path to Power, Means of Ascent, and Master of the Senate.
Caro, Power and Prose, from our February 8, 2009 broadcast. Talking about his latest Johnson volume, The Passage of Power, Caro has stressed the distance and disdain in which LBJ as Veep was held by the Kennedys, and the calculation Johnson made that fate might cut Camelot short and put him in the Oval Office without having to win a national election. Asked how well Johnson could wield power in the far more polarized politics of today, with less party discipline and much more money for ideologically extreme campaign challenges, Caro still thinks LBJ would find the levers to get his way. I'm Kaimana Larson. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, thinking of Johnson, Jackie, and Kennedy's Camelot Come and Gone, film star Richard Burton with the title tune of the 1960 Broadway musical.
It's true. It's true. The Crown has made it clear. The climate must be perfect all the year. A law was made a distant moon ago here. July and August cannot be too hot. And there's a legal limit to the snow here in Camelot. The winter is forbidden till December. And exits March the 2nd on the dot. By order, summer lingers through September in Camelot. Camelot, Camelot, I know it sounds a bit bizarre, but in Camelot, Camelot, that's how conditions are. The rain may never fall till after sundown. By 8 the morning fog must disappear. In short, there's simply not a more congenial spot for happily ever aftering than here in Camelot. Gives a person pause, but in Camelot, Camelot, those are the legal laws. The snow may never slush upon the hillside. By 9 p.m. the moonlight must appear. In short, there's simply not a more congenial spot for happily ever aftering than here in Camelot.